This episode is dedicated to the memory of superfan David Fowler. David, I want to ask you, before we get too far into this super show that we're going to be doing, and we do need to truck on because we're covering all of the movies, all of those super movies. I need to know, David Klink, where you stand on Superman's red shorts. Because over the years, they've come, they've gone. Some people have said, well, he's wearing his underwear on the outside, which isn't the case. This is, you know, we know that the costume design was based on the strongmen from the turn of the previous century. But some people like it without the red shorts. I, my friend, tend to be pro red short. How about you?
I'm all red all the time.
Oh, that's super. And I'm not being an ass by saying that, but
I say red them and weep. Oh, sorry.
I'm not big on like going back into films like George Lucas does and changing elements. But if I could do anything with the recent Superman series, I would go back and give him the red shorts. And I've heard actually some people say one of the reasons they don't like it is because it draws your eye too much to his crotch when there is no red, because you're kind of like, well, what's going on down there? The red sort of just, it breaks up the blue, all that blue. And so aesthetically, I think it's a good touch. And I know that if I was flying around, see, I don't think of it as underwear on the outside. When he doesn't have the red, I think of it as he's wearing long johns. Mm. And I know what it's like as a man when you got your junk in long johns, like it can end up anywhere. So I think containment is an issue that Superman would need. How do you feel?
Well, I think there was that red crotch at morning, sailor take warning or something like that. But yeah, I think there is a saying about it, but I wouldn't go back. I mean, if you're going to go back and start tinkering with things, then how about changing the whole crotch area into a walkie-talkie? Like, have they not thought of that? Like, take your from E.T.
Yeah.
Or Flowers or whatever the heck they did to not scare a kid. Like, if there's a walkie-talkie there instead of red shorts, like, that might scare the kids a bit. I don't know.
Oh, I like that. I like the sort of freak factor of that. But I mean, it would look weird if either Jimmy Olsen or Lois Lane had to use the walkie-talkie. I mean, that would
Well, Superman is an extraterrestrial. So it had a whole new meaning to ET phone home. But we're getting silly, aren't we?
We are, but
welcome to Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. I'm David Klink.
Yes. And we also talk crotchal area.
Yes.
We should just change the emphasis of the whole show to that.
And he is Troy Harkin, for God's sake. If he's not going to say it.
I am. It's true. You've just outed me. God damn it. The secret is out there. Only Lois Lane is supposed to know that I'm Troy Harkin. Anyway. Yes.
This is our second part of, I guess I'm calling it a duology of episodes, looking at Superman. Our first episode looked at the comics and TV and some other things. This episode, we'll look at the movies. This is our third episode of season 5, hole number 59, if I even have the math right. Saturday, November 4th is when it's dropping. No guest for this episode. And by the way, Troy, can you give people a spoiler alert?
I can. Let me just go up and push the button that used to be in the Fortress of Solitude.
Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert!
Very nice. Thanks, Troy. We're recording this session via Zoom.
Mm-hmm.
And
Zoom. Just like Superman flying.
Yeah, which has gotten better over the years, hasn't it? But that's an aside.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You had a question for me, I think?
I almost had a question, but it was basically Superman. Because I've been watching, I'm getting these all conflated. I've watched all of these films many times over the last few weeks.
Yeah.
And they're starting to conflate meld together.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, this happened in this film. No, it happened in that one, and so on.
Yeah. And the problem is, David, you and I, you and I have both watched like various versions, like alternate cuts and whatnot, in which sometimes one film has an element to it in one film, and sometimes it's in another film. And so I know you're talking about that confusion.
Yeah. And there's that 4-hour cut of Zack Snyder's one, which we'll get into later, that, you know, at a certain point, people, I think some of our fans are very much into thinking that we should really be concentrating on the theatrical release, because that's sort of canon, and anything else is just sort of gravy, isn't it?
Yeah. Sorry, that is a really lame ass response, David. I'm sorry, but you might say that. And I guess we should just sort of truck along, right? Because we have a number of feature films here that we need to cover.
Well, why don't you start with the first one that's considered really the first movie?
Well, I will. Now, we did mention on our previous Superman film that there had been the cereal, not the cereal that you eat, which Kellogg's was actually a sponsor of The Adventures of Superman, not cereal with a C, but cereal with an S. And there was actually cereals of Batman, Superman, and Captain Marvel, meaning the original Captain Marvel, Shazam, as we know him now, back in the olden days, the olden times.
Well, Troy, now that you're mentioning cereal for a second, because I just thought of this today. I don't know if this is any good, but I was thinking there should have been a kryptonite cereal, and they could actually say settling of continents may occur. You know, that whole settling of contents?
Yes.
See what I did with that?
I think I do.
You could have an exploding Krypton on the actual thing. You feel, you know, I'm doing my part to destroy Krypton by eating the cereal.
But are we endangering Superman by creating the cereal?
Oh, right. Yeah. That's possible.
But maybe, you know, maybe we're making him stronger, because maybe it's like a vaccine. Maybe the more he's exposed to kryptonite, then the better he'll be in the long run. Anyway. Let's touch on Superman and the Mole Men from 1951. Now, it's a wee film. It only comes in at 58 minutes long. It was directed by Lee Sholem, and it was written by, according to the screen credit, Richard Fielding, but that was a pseudonym of two writers who would end up working on the Adventures of Superman TV series. And those two writers were Robert Maxwell and Whitney Ellsworth. Now, in essence, Superman and the Mole Man acted very much like a pilot for the then upcoming Adventures of Superman TV show. The plot tells of an oil crew that inadvertently releases subterranean people who the Earthlings, well, the upper Earthlings, they fear, and they try to kill the subterranean people. Now, Lois and Clark have come to the site of the oil drill to cover a news story for the Daily Planet when they learn of the so-called Mole Men. Superman is then forced to intervene on behalf of the little people and save them from the xenophobic gun-toting yahoos. Now, we don't get Perry White in this. We don't get Jimmy Olsen. We're not even in Metropolis. The whole film is set around the oil drill site. But we do get Superman, and we get George Reeves in his Superman film.
Don't even try to get in there, Benson. Dr. Reed's in charge tonight. He's left orders that no one's to be admitted.
That's your answer, mister.
It may be an answer to you. It means nothing to me.
Yeah, well, we're running this town. We ought to string you up, too.
Yeah!
Are you all right, Miss Lane?
You're going to step aside or we have to make trouble.
Put some lead in him, Luke.
Mr. Benson tried that once already. It didn't work. Now I'm going to give you one last chance to stop acting like Nazi stormtroopers.
Who are you to tell us what to do?
All I'm telling you is that little creature in there has as much right to live as you do. Don't forget, you invaded his world. You sank a pipe 6 miles into the ground. And when he climbed up, you set dogs on him, shot him.
And stay away from the front of the building.
Whoever fired that shot came close to killing Miss Lane. Obviously, none of you can be trusted with guns, so I'm going to take them away from you.
You may have seen the film actually on the TV show, as at one point in August 1953, it was divided into a two-part episode, then known as The Unknown People, not The Mole Men. And yeah, it was kind of fun to come across this film because I hadn't seen it. The thing was shot, David, in 12 days. So wow. It really does have a B-movie feel to it. And I wanted to point out, too, that film starred Phyllis Coates as Lois Lane. And she would play that part for season one of The Adventures of Superman on TV. And on October 11th, 2023, we lost Phyllis Coates as she passed away as we were prepping the show. She was 96. But that's the only sort of pre-Christopher Reeve Superman. But do you have any, you want to give some love to George Reeves?
Absolutely. Yeah, and it was nice that they did this because this did lead to the Adventures of Superman. And yeah. That's something that we had mentioned on the Commander Tom show, whatever it was, that this certainly had a life in syndication. It just kept being on TV to the point where I watched it when I was a kid.
Yeah. Yep. Now, one of the things that we're going to do as we whip through these films, because we're going to try to get it in just a little over an hour. But we're going to give, David and I will give you our personal ratings. Now, for me, this one, I give it 2 out of 5 super S's, as in the S on Superman's chest. I give it 2 out of 5. It's not the worst Superman film. So I probably have it in, for me, at my like second least favorite. But hey, again, we get George Reeves on the big screen. And we also get Phyllis Coates as Lois. So yeah, it looks exactly the way it should as a B movie from the 50s, but it's still better than one that came out a couple decades later, which we'll get to in a little bit.
I would give it a 2 as well for the same reasons. It also has a bit of a message, you know, about, mm-hmm. you know, accepting people and other things. It's just, I think that's what science fiction and the things we like in genre, science fiction, fantasy, and horror, that they can cast a light on what we're experiencing without hitting you over the head with it. I guess maybe this one does hit you over the head a bit, but it's something that, you know, I think it was more designed for a bit of a younger audience. Like if you're watching with your parents, maybe you get more of the message of it, because it has to be spelled out a bit more if you're a bit younger, possibly. I don't know.
Yeah, and that really is the case for all of the Superman films until we get to sort of the Snyderverse era with Henry Cavill as Superman. It's all skews kind of like younger for sure. And yeah, Superman and the Mole Man is no exception. So should we get on to that first biggie one?
Yeah, it might be the greatest one of all.
So in 78, we get Superman the movie, or I guess as some will call it retroactively, Superman 1. It was directed by Richard Donner. The story was by Mario Puzo, and it was produced by Ilya and Alexander Salkind, who had done the 3 and 4 Musketeers.
And I tell you that we must evacuate this planet immediately.
Jor-El, be reasonable.
Once there was a civilization, much like ours, but with a greater intelligence, greater powers, and a greater capacity for good. that world was destroyed. But there was one survivor.
Now, wouldn't that beat all Get Out?
Because of the wisdom and compassion of Jor-El, because he knew the human race had the capacity for goodness, he sent us his only son. His name is Kal-El. He will call himself Clark Kent. But the world will know him as Superman. This year, Superman brings you the gift of flight. Superman, the movie.
And this was it. This was, you know, one of the granddaddy Hollywood blockbusters of the 1970s. It was fresh off all the hoopla and success that was Star Wars. Superman was made for $50 million and grossed over $300 million worldwide. It was the second biggest box office draw of 1978, second only to Grease. Superman the movie involved both the star and writer of The Godfather, and it cast an unknown actor to bring to life the Man of Steel. This was the first live-action portrayal of Superman on the big or little screen since the death of George Reeves. Superman the movie does a lot in its 153 minutes of screen time. We get an iconic John Williams theme. We see the destruction of Krypton. We have baby Kal-El's escape and his safe arrival in Kansas. We also get the stunning Fortress of Solitude set. Mm. Now, it's easy to forget that prior to this, the Fortress of Solitude had been depicted in the comic books as basically an Arctic version of the Batcave. As envisioned by designer John Barry, the Fortress of Solitude is transformed into a crystal palace. Now, that iconic vision is still the way Superman's secret lair is depicted. And remarkably, the producers attempted to shoot the sequel, Superman II, concurrently, which they did for the most part. Richard Donner had shot 75% of the sequel before a number of issues forced the production team to focus solely on the completion of that first film. The original ending called for Superman stopping a missile in mid-flight, launching it into outer space and inadvertently striking the three prisoners in the Phantom Zone. And as a result, they were released. In the original theatrical version of the film, we instead have Superman undoing Luthor's destruction by flying backwards around the Earth at super speed and turning back time. Dave, what are your thoughts on that original film?
Well, I think that that song, If You Can Turn Back Time, by Cher,
yep,
was about, okay, maybe it wasn't about this.
No, that's a Superman outfit that needs to be considered. But again, you have to know that video and you have to be old farts like us. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and we can always imagine Superman sitting on one of those turrets. But anyways,
yeah.
So it really set the standard. And I may have said this before, but all you have to do is try to get the largest screen at home. Or if it's ever re-released, you know, if it ever shows up in one of these old style theaters near you, go and see it. Because for some of us who are lucky enough to see it in the theater, I probably saw it at the university in Toronto years ago.
Oh, wow.
Back in 78, was that the whole opening credits, if you take the time to do your opening credits right, with that music, with those credits just going on the screen and the way they were presented, already had me sold. It was just like one of the greatest moments in sort of like movie credit history.
Yeah.
And everything in it, like from the whole thing with the helicopter. I mean, there are some clunky bits, like I've been a poet for a very long time. And the whole thing with Superman flying with Lois, and then there's this monologue thing, which could have been written by the people who had that sound over, or whatever you call it, in Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. Remember that original when it was brought in, they had to have someone doing this voiceover or talking behind the story to get you clued in. There was this Margot Kidder's voice doing this, what is quite horrific poetry about all this rhyming stuff about
how wonderful it is
to be flying with Superman. And that is still cringeworthy to this day.
Can you read my mind? Do you know what it is that you do to me? I don't know who you are. Just a friend from another star. Here I am, like a kid out of school, holding hands with a god. I'm a fool. Look at me, quivering, like a little girl, shivering. You can see right through me. Can you read my mind? Can you picture the things I'm thinking of? Wondering why you are. All the wonderful things you are. You can fly. You belong in the sky. You and I could belong to each other. If you need a friend, I'm the one to fly to. You need to be loved. Here I am. Read my mind.
Hey, but other than that, the film is and watching it again was a bit concerning for me because I'd lost my wife in February. And just seeing the whole thing where Lois dies and then him trying to bring her back was a bit of a... issue, and it's similar to some of the later films where they deal with loss and death, which we all have to in our lives.
Yeah, a lot of resonance, I would assume.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned the music again, because I think it needs to be talked about a lot. Like, as we know, John Williams is kind of like the Beatles of music, movie music. It's like there's so many great themes that we can talk about, but I do think that the Superman theme and his Superman score in general is way up there. It's way up there. It might be my favorite of his sort of epic themes. And the scenes when, like I forget what they actually call it. I don't know if it's called the romance theme or the Lois and Clark theme or something like that. But the music when they're flying, that music does so much of the heavy lifting for those scenes. Because it doesn't always look that great. I think, I don't know if I get into it here or later, but just some of the visuals, like it's just I always have a problem with the physics behind the way they're flying, the way he's flying with her, you know, like, especially there's a bit where he just, it's like fingertip to fingertip.
Yeah. So how is she not fall? There's some force there.
Yeah.
Keeping her up.
But I will say again, that music helps sell those scenes.
Yes.
And, we can also talk a little bit more about Margot Kidder's Lois. I love her performance. That's another thing that helps sell that. And actually the chemistry between Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidder, it's really great screen chemistry. But yeah, Kidder's Lois, I had notes that it's sassy, snarky, and it's age appropriate, because some of the other ones, particularly I forget her name now, but the Lois that is in Superman Returns, I found she's just seemed far too young to be
Kate Bosworth. I think.
Yes, Kate Bosworth. Yeah, I didn't buy her, but Margot Kidder, I definitely buy.
Well, if and we've recommended this before, but there is a documentary called Up, Up in the Way or something like that. That's about an hour and 50 minutes. It covers a lot of the Superman history. And they actually show some of the screen tests with people like Stockard Channing, who I absolutely love, and some of these other women trying out for the role. And you can actually see, I can see why they do this, why they have a number of people trying out these things. And I mean, if you reach a certain level, I don't think that it's considered an insult if you have to come and actually try out for a role. You're supposed to just get it because of who you are. But you can see the chemistry between Margot Kidder and Christopher Reeve, and that whole thing where she says, oh, Clark thinks that you're some kind of a puppet or held up by strings, and she said, like Peter Pan, and his whole response about how, you know, Peter Pan was a story for children in a fairy tale. It's such a brilliant moment. And I think this guy's got game. You know, he's, by saying that, he's, you know, it's sort of like Spock saying, I've never met a, she says, I've never met a Vulcan before. And he says, I've never met a piece of art, a work of art before. You know, that kind of thing where you think, here's a character that you don't think has got game, suddenly says the thing that just says, wow. You take your breath is taken away by how amazing that is.
Now, what do you?
So, yeah, definitely Margot Kidder is good.
Yeah, and I do love Christopher Reeve's Superman. I'm not nuts about his Clark, which goes so far the other way. And I realize that, you know, even when you think back to the Adventures of Superman with George Reeves, his Clark, I mean, he is mild mannered. But he's not wimpy or wussy or whatever in the
way. He's very confident. Like
he is, yes.
The way he is with people, it's like it's not awkward. It's not. There's nothing awkward, I don't think, with the George Reeves, Clark Kent. And I think you're right. I think part of it was the purpose of it was. I think they just go a bit too far because sometimes you just go too far to make it obvious how different people are. So I think they played up so much that it is too much.
Yeah. And there is also this thing too, that I actually have a note for it somewhere here, but I can paraphrase it. One of the things that we do get with the Christopher Reeve era Superman is that this is all pre things like Watchmen in the comics and Sandman by Neil Gaiman. And Dark Knight by Frank Miller, where with that era of comic books, it created a seismic shift in the way those stories were told. And they all of a sudden became adult stories with, you know, mature storylines. So prior to that, you know, comics were still thought of as kids stuff. Mm. And so I think, like it took a long time, and I don't, and you know, I love Batman 66, but it took a long time to shake off the influence of what that series and that one feature film had done in terms of telling these stories. They were still thought of it as either these are sort of stories for kids, or we might have like a double entendre for adults that they might clue into, but it's still kind of jokey. You know, and that's just the history of it. That's just the way it was. We hadn't hit that point where all of a sudden we can tell super tragic stories in a mature way. We weren't there yet, but we would get there eventually.
Thing you mentioned is about the take on, like one thing that's a bugaboo for you, and I agree with it, is the idea of the soft takeoffs and landings. So you want to talk for a minute about that?
Well, you know, again, I did grow up with the George Reeves takeoffs, which were not, there was no special effects in it. So we actually saw a man dealing with gravity. So he, you know, for his takeoffs, he would basically use he would use a trampoline and then bound upward and out of the shot. But it felt very powerful. You know, and his landings were the reverse. He would swing on a bar through a window and then land with the force of gravity behind him. Now, clearly we're dealing with a character who, you know, we have to suspend disbelief and we have to try to allow for the fact that somehow this guy can fly, and somehow we can allow for it within the laws of physics. We have to somehow like do that. But when I see Christopher Reeve's Superman do the soft liftoff, it looks more magical. It takes it out of the realm of science and things like thrust and force, and it somehow makes it magical. Even the fact that he can levitate, that he can, you know, be 3 feet above the ground with his arms crossed, having a dialogue with Lois. I like that looks good, but I have a hard time buying it. What about you?
I agree. One of the things I like about the Henry Cavill ones is that they are hard to like he actually asked at one point for Lois, the Amy Adams character, to move back. And then he said, actually, you might want to move back a bit further. And then she has to move back a bit further. Then he, you know, does his thing and the effects of it, what it actually damages. Like he starts, you know, sort of like Hancock or whatever the film was with Will Smith. You actually start damaging things, like, you know, you're gonna go off this pavement. Well, now they have to replace that piece of pavement or that sidewalk or wherever it is anytime you do this hard takeoff, because he's actually damaging it every time he does that.
Yeah, for sure.
But I like that.
And
I prefer
now,
that though.
I mean, we've had a few things that you know, we're looking back on this film, I guess getting close to 50 years, right? Mm. And as much as there are things that, you know, we would wish were different, we still, you know, give total kudos to this film. The fact that it was the first. This is the first real big budget blockbuster color Superman film. And man, like it's just changed everything.
Yeah. And what they did with the effects of the time, which again, this is the Star Wars era. So there was a lot to do, and they already made a major leap with that film, but it's so much better now. What they were able to do in that film was quite astonishing. And a lot of it still holds up, just like 2001, a lot of the effects.
Yeah.
You know, if you do it right, you put the money in and you care about it, it can stand up over time.
Yeah. And the last thing I wanted to touch on too was with that controversial ending that we got for Superman, the movie in the released form, where he goes backwards around the earth at super speed to turn back time. This became a huge sticking point in the history of the character because, you know, you've got the question, how do you create jeopardy for a character that is invulnerable and not just a demigod, but much closer to a god? If he can do that, what can't he do? You know, so.
Well, the other thing he could do, because this is a bit silly, but then you have to talk about how they connect to each other. Because if he knew that he was able to do this, then when he actually runs into General Zod in Man of Steel, and Zod said, by the way, when you activated something on that ship, it actually sent a signal, which meant I could then find you. And he said, oh, well, I'm just going to now go around the earth a bunch of times previously before I press that button and make sure I don't press it.
Yeah. And they could have just from that point on called him Backwards Man, Rewind Man, you know? Like, oh no, he's going to backwards again. But yeah, exactly. So sort of as a indirect result of the film and storylines that then said that Superman can do anything with these powers, they dialed it back. They dialed it back quite a lot, which was a challenge. But again, it made it a little bit easier for writers once they had a character that actually could be hurt in some form or another. Anyway, David, I gave the original Superman the movie 4 out of 5 super S's for all the things that it did do right and for you know, being there and getting those things right. How about you?
Yeah, if I were to give it a 4, that would probably be on the lower end of I know there are a few questions and a few things, and we haven't even got into Gene Hackman and Ned Beatty and all that. Like, there's just so much good in this. I would probably give it 4.5 if we're allowed half stars, and possibly even a 5, possibly, because it's that, other than the few, like, you have to accept the fact that something cannot be perfect. But yeah, 4.5 or 5 on that one. It's just, it is the film of all of the Superman movies. I think it is number one.
Yeah, I probably could have gone a little bit higher. Like, I was actually even thinking, like, do I want to do 4.5? I could do that. Or do I want to do 4.25? I could maybe do that. But anyway, as it was, I've stuck so far with 4 to 5 super S's. Well, we move on to Superman 2 from 1981, and we will be talking here sort of both about Superman 2 and what became known as the Donner Cut of Superman 2. The film is credited to director Richard Lester, who also was the director of the Beatles films A Hard Day's Night and Help. So there's your Beatlesism for this episode. The film grossed $190 million. It was the second highest grossing film of 1981. Coming in second only to Raiders of the Lost Ark. The film's producers, the Salkins, had a falling out with director Richard Donner as they were completing Superman the movie. They also refused to pay Marlon Brando for the scenes he had shot for Superman 2. So rather than using that footage, they reshot those scenes between Clark and Jor-El using Susanna York as Superman's Kryptonian mother, Lara. It was essential for Richard Lester to shoot a certain amount of footage to receive credit as the film's director. There were some scenes filmed by Lester that, when intercut with Donner's footage from 2 years previous, the contrast was highly noticeable. In particular were the scenes intercutting footage of Margot Kidder, who had been suffering substance abuse problems in the intervening years. There were all kinds of acrimony surrounding the making of Superman 2, and not just between Richard Donner and the Salkinds. The Salkinds also threatened lawsuits against Brando as well as Christopher Reeve. While composer John Williams couldn't get along with the new director, Richard Lester, so Williams left. Creative consultant Tom Mankiewicz also left the production out of loyalty to Richard Donner. Director Lester, he was directing the film partly as a settlement in a previous legal action against the Salkinds. It's remarkable that Superman 2 ended up being a success at all. Superman 2 is still an entertaining and rewatchable film. Some of the things that I really liked about it was, well, you and I both talked about Sarah Douglas as Ursa, for one thing, right?
Absolutely. Sarah Douglas was excellent. And as you probably say, Terrence Stamp, like just as a pair of baddies.
Yeah.
Pretty darn good, eh?
Yeah, you were, David, you were in the Phantom Zone, or as Richard Donner calls it, was the Silent Zone. Yeah, no, they were great. Like, I found them really compelling from the first time I'd seen this film. It felt like, here we had some villains that, you know, were much more of a serious threat than, say, Lex and Warren Beatty.
Absolutely. And it's very, you know, if you can actually have these people that actually do breathe air from Krypton somehow being able to fly through space, and to be able to talk to people on the moon when there's no atmosphere and things like that. And then we'll get later into one of the later movies where they use some device on Superman to actually encompass him in sunning and says, how do you think he's going to do without air? Well, he's been traveling in space all this time. That, you know, it's a bit odd how they handle that, because I don't think that's handled quite right. They are... Yeah. Living beings that actually do need air to be able to breathe and to be able to sustain life. And you can't talk on the moon. So other than that, anyways, I just had to say that.
Yeah, no, we do get some issues with our science when Superman is in space, especially when he later goes into space with a Hemingway. You get the great Kneel Before Zod line, which has been reused multiple times in different Superman storytelling. And we get the great Niagara Falls scene. Again, I know that's one of the ones that you and I both really like between Clark and Lois.
Absolutely.
Yep. And I always generally like a second film better than the original film in a series, just because there's less origin, less setup going on. We know who the characters are and we're getting on with it. And one of the things that I really liked about this series that later superhero movies, like it became a thing in, I guess, 90s or early aughts for superhero films to have not just one villain, but multiple villains. And for me, that just always took up so much storytelling time. Like, do one story at a time, be true to the character. So I like that in this, even though we get the return of Lex.
I agree. They did the same thing with Spider-Man. They had this setup for Spider-Man. Then the second one was only Doc Ock. Brilliant. And it was a second film. It was even better than the first. You're right about that setup. The third one, they had Sandman and Venom or whatever it was, and that didn't work for me. It would have been better if it was just Sandman. So you're right. Yeah. It's better to really have just the one. Unless you're talking about Batman 66 and you get all of them in there and camp it up. But I think you're right. You need one strong adversary, I think.
Yeah, well, the downfall or the what would have happened if they tried to sort of adapt Batman 66 into a modern film is we would have got 20 minutes of backstory with every villain as well, you know. Thank God we didn't get that. It would have been a 2.5-hour film of the Adam West Batman. And as much as we love our Batman, we don't need that much. I wasn't nuts about... In the released version of Superman 2, Lois discovers that Clark is Superman by him falling into a fireplace. Like, here's a guy who can float in your universe. Why does he fall into a fireplace and disclose who he is? And why doesn't he go back 2 minutes in time so that doesn't happen? Anyway.
I think he was watching a rerun of Dick Van Dyke. And he was tripping over something, and I think that was in an homage, possibly.
I can do that. Yeah, he can do that. And also, not nuts about the super amnesia kiss at the Daily Planet. Do you have any sort of dislikes you want to touch on?
Is that canon at all, by the way, Troy? Did you really know your Superman? That's just out of the blue. Like, this whole idea that Superman can kiss you to cause amnesia. That's just someone pulling that out of their butts, isn't it?
Yeah, I think probably the producers, maybe, because we get that as the series goes on, too, these powers that Superman doesn't really have, but that he gets attributed to. Like, I believe it's in Superman 4, where he has this undo vision, where he can look at something that's been done, like damage to the Great Wall of China. He can look at it, and it gets undone. It gets repaired.
That was weird.
Yeah, like there's just a number of things like that.
Yeah, why don't you just kiss General Zod?
Yes.
Just let him forget, you know?
Yeah. Like, and that should be his other thing. He should just be randomly kissing people to make them forget. Like, kiss Lex Luthor, make him forget his villainous plans, and he'd be fine. Do we want to touch on the Donner Cut, which you and I checked out a week or so ago?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Go right ahead.
Okay. There was sort of a move, an internet movement to have the original version of Superman 2 assembled, that Richard Donner had intended to be released before he was let go from the film. So Superman 2, the Donner Cut version, begins with... I'm just going to let you know some of the differences here. The film begins with Lois figuring out Clark is Superman, and she attempts to prove it by leaping out of a window at the Daily Planet. Clark rushes down to the ground, uses his super breath to bring her down slowly, opens an awning with his heat vision, which Lois bounces off of and into a fruit stand where she ends up covered in tomatoes. Meanwhile, Clark rushes back to the window from which she jumped and yells, "Lois, what have you done?" Which was a cute scene, I thought. How'd you feel about that one, David?
Yeah, I like that one. And there's even this one that I like more, because I'm not sure if that sort of stepped over the later scene. But I do like the whole thing. There's a scene which I don't think was in the theatrical one where she's drawing glasses.
Oh, yes.
An image of Superman, and she's doing this whole thing in the office that I thought was great.
Yeah, it really was. And that's what leads into her leaping out of the window. Later in Niagara Falls, Lois shoots Clark to prove he's really Superman, because she still has this idea in her head. And this time she proves it.
You are Superman, aren't you?
Lois, look, we've been through these hallucinations of yours before.
Can't you see what you almost did? Throwing yourself off a building 30 stories high? Can't you see what a tragic mistake you almost made?
I made a mistake. I made a mistake because I risked my life instead of yours.
Lois, don't be insane.
And don't fall down, because you're just going to have to get up again.
Lois, now don't be crazy now.
What?
I've known this for the longest time.
You realize, of course, if you'd been wrong, Clark Kent would have been killed.
With a blank? Gotcha.
Well, seeing that cut was great, because I would watch it. It wasn't the theatrical. So other than watching this, you have no idea that could have been in the actual movie. And watching it, I was pulled in just as Clark Kent was. Like, I was pulled. I thought that she actually shot him. And then when she actually says, oh, it was a blank, but how does he should realize there's a blank if he's Superman, because nothing hit him.
Right.
But anyways, there's a bit of logic there, I think, that was a bit odd.
Yeah. Now, there were some scenes where Donner was forced to use the actor's test footage because the scenes had never been shot otherwise. And that Lois shooting Clark section is one of those scenes. Donner also restores the Brando footage of Jor-El in dialogue with Clark / Kal-El. And in doing so, Donner restores the father-son dynamic that is really a through line between Superman the movie and Superman 2. The Donner cut of Superman 2 won the Saturn Award for Best DVD Special Edition in 2006. And I'm really glad it exists, and I'm glad that I picked it up, because I think it's fairly hard to find now. But yeah, it's kind of cool to see that one.
Yeah, it was worth seeing. Plus, was it one of those special things on the DVD that we watched where we had them commenting on what they were doing? Or was that, because I remember we were watching something where Donner was talking about all the changes and all of the things that he did with the thing.
That was part of the commentary.
When you had the commentary on.
One of those things that makes the DVD really worth having, because you get the entire restored film, you get it with commentary from Donner and Mankiewicz, and then you get I think 20 minute sort of making of, like, how the process and what it involved to put that thing together.
Well, the comments I really appreciate too, because we did the same thing with the thing where you had the main actor and the director talking about the comments. So I really appreciated Donner talking about how much he liked Christopher Reeve and how great and how wonderful a person he was on set. So I do appreciate that.
Yeah. Now, so with the original released version of Superman 2 and Superman 2, the Donner cut, over the years, I find that's one of those cases where I do conflate everything. I did always like the original Superman 2. I think I like Superman 2, the Donner cut, a little bit better. But I'm going to give it sort of a joint grade. So I went with 4 out of 5 Super S's for me.
Yeah, I would probably give it more like 3.5. Like, I just can't hold it. I appreciate the fact that you like the second one better than the first. And I know that there are people who like Aliens more than Alien, even though I'm an Alien fan. But for this, the first one is so much better for me, at least. But what's nice is that the second one is a standalone movie, and it really does take the character forward. But I just don't think it's as strong a film. So I would probably give it 3.5.
Okay. So now we get into the slightly goofier territory for the next two. Superman 3 was released in 1983. It was directed by Richard Lester. So this is his first full kick at the can without having to deal with, you know, somebody else's footage. The film made $80 million worldwide, less than half of Superman 2, but it still finished in the top 5 grossing films of the year. The basic plot has Richard Pryor's character, Gus Gorman. He becomes a computer hacker and shaves percentage points off of checks and deposits them into his own account. And that was actually reused in the comedy classic Office Space.
That virus you're always talking about, right? The one that could rip off the company for a bunch of money.
Yeah? What about it?
Well, how does it work?
It's pretty brilliant. What it does is every time there's a bank transaction where interest is computed, and there are thousands a day, the computer ends up with these fractions of a cent, which it usually rounds off. But what this does is it takes those little remainders and puts it into an account.
This sounds familiar.
Yeah, they did in Superman 3.
Right.
Yeah. Underrated movie, actually.
Annette O'Toole as Lana Lang is fantastic. Easily, this is my favorite part of the film, the stuff that involves Annette O'Toole. I really loved the Smallville reunion scenes, and I've got a Beatleism for you there, Dave, where the Beatles version of Roll Over Beethoven plays at the Smallville reunion. This film is goofy. It's goofy. Although it's more than a decade after the fact, the feel of these Superman films cannot escape the campiness of Batman 66, which I have touched on, so I won't repeat myself there. One of the things I do love about the film, too, is we get the evil Superman. There's a split where evil Superman is doing a bunch of bad shit, and he fixes the Leaning Tower of Pisa, so it's no longer leaning, and the tourist merchants are all upset about that. We have evil Superman blowing out the Olympic torch. And we have him causing an oil spill, which is a little bit more serious than those other two things. And we also get this great fight scene between good and evil Superman. And his portrayal, Christopher Reeve as evil Superman, is for me one of the highlights of the series, even though the film itself is not that strong. But his performance, I thought, was great. And in his evil Superman uniform, he wears the muted colors that we end up seeing as part of the palette of the Zack Snyder films, which I thought was interesting, where the red is not Crayola red. It's kind of like a darker burgundy. What do you feel about all the goings on of Superman 3, David?
Well, thank you for lending me the DVDs for 3 and 4. I had avoided watching these films because I had heard that they were so bad. And then that confirmed it upon watching them. But I have to say that they do have some highlights. Certainly Richard Pryor, you can watch him in anything because he's one of the great comedic geniuses of the past 40, 50 years. He makes the film. And when we eventually get to the fourth one, bringing back Gene Hackman is brilliant too. So we'll get to that in a minute. But there are some good aspects for sure in this film. But I think I could have survived without having seen it.
Yeah, and one note that I had, which I thought was kind of weird, was, did you notice this or did you find this, that when the villains, it's not Lex, but it's just a sort of an evil corporate overlord guy, when they go to their lair in the Grand Canyon, the computer looks just like the Batcave nuclear reactor in Batman 66. Did you notice that? Like it is the same design, but bigger.
Yeah, I guess they just took it or you know, how different do these things look anyways? You know, you got the overlord computer thing with all the buttons that are flashing. But you're right, it has a bit. I mean, they should have had little things that say what the actual instrument does on top of it.
Oh, that would have been great.
Would have added, yeah, that would have been wonderful. I think you also have a note about Annette O'Toole, who's actually played different people in the movies.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I think I call that the Back to the Future aspect. Now, obviously, if I'm seeing this through after years of watching Smallville and seeing Annette O'Toole on it, and so on Smallville, Annette O'Toole plays Martha Kent, Clark Kent's mom. And so for me, it had this really weird Back to the Future feel of he goes back to the reunion in Superman 3, and, you know, he's kind of hitting on Annette O'Toole, who's playing Lana Lang, and she's sweet on him. And so it has this, like, you know, holy incest vibe of Marty McFly that I always feel about Back to the Future. I always have a hard time with Back to the Future because of the goings on between him and his mom. But yeah, so that's probably just me. Yeah.
You gave it a rating, right? A 3.
Oh yeah. Sorry. I gave it a 2.5 out of 5. And that's, I'm like, you know, it certainly doesn't live up to the first two. Like, clearly, I would never want to mislead anybody. It's not very good, but it's watchable. If it's on TV, you might want to watch it. You know, and you do get these great scenes with Annette O'Toole. You do get to see Richard Pryor. And, you know, generally you can't lose. Actually, I guess Lois is in this very little because of the whole setup with Lana. Like, she goes on on a vacation to Hawaii or something and returns.
Right, and Robert Vaughn.
Film. Yeah.
Robert Vaughn is
The villain, right?
The villain. So that's pretty good too. I would give it a 2 myself.
Yeah.
But you're right. It certainly has some, because I love Richard Pryor, love Robert Vaughn. Christopher Reeve and so on, and Annette O'Toole. So yeah, it's got some good actors in it. It just didn't quite have the story.
No, and it felt like the budget was like severely cut too. So I can't wait to hear your number of super S's for number 4.
The greatest hope against the threat of nuclear war is Superman.
I'm going to do what our governments have been unwilling or unable to do. Effective immediately, I'm going to rid our planet of all nuclear weapons.
The greatest threat to Superman is Lex Luthor.
Smarter than I thought. We can make the world safe for war profits.
He's created the ultimate weapon to annihilate the Man of Steel.
You'd risk worldwide nuclear war for your own personal financial gain. Nobody wants war. I just want to keep the threat alive.
Dude of Steel, where are you gonna get it?
You know you're a workaholic. Let's just stop and smell the roses, huh?
Superman 4, Christopher Reeve, Gene Hackman, Jackie Cooper, John Cryer, with Mariel Hemingway and Margot Kidder as Lois Lane. Superman 4, his most important adventure, the quest for peace.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, Superman 4, The Quest for Peace, was released in 1987. It was directed by Sidney Furie. It only made $36 million, less than half of Superman 3. The final cut ran at only 90 minutes after a test screening saw the need to remove about an hour from its running time. And David, I have a very perverse desire to see the uncut version of this film. And
it might save it. It might actually say this is a stunt. You know, it's sort of like with all the cutting they did to Star Trek, the motion sickness when they brought back the restored one made a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Same thing with the Snyder Cut and all this kind of thing. Sometimes when they've cut a film, they've actually cut the core of it. I have a feeling this may not be the case here.
Yeah, no, but I am curious to find out. So we need to get an internet petition going to have the restored version of Superman 4. Christopher Reeve, who obviously was Superman, and he conceived of the disarmament storyline, he called Superman 4, quote, a catastrophe from start to finish, end of quote. At the behest of a young boy, Superman decides to rid the world of nuclear weapons by flying them into outer space. He should have just flown backwards until Oppenheimer was about to be born and then stop there.
That's good idea. That's a story.
Yeah. Anyway, also in the story, we have Mariel Hemingway falling in love with Clark, not Superman, which was interesting. She falls in love with Clark, not Superman. And Lex is back. And this time he plans on destroying Superman by creating Nuclear Man, a being as strong as Superman. that plot point does foreshadow Doomsday, interestingly enough, in the comics 13 years later. Gene Hackman, yeah, he's back as Lex. And along with him, instead of Warren Beatty, we have, hold on, not Warren Beatty, Ned Beatty. Warren Beatty, yeah, that would have been awesome.
Yeah, that would have been different.
Let's recast that. That's what I should have done for my later casting. Anyway, yeah, this time it's Lenny Luthor, played by John Cryer. And Cryer would actually play Lex Luthor in the TV series Supergirl. Okay, let's unpack this a little bit more. This one gets really lame once Nuclear Man arrives midway through the film. At one point, Nuclear Man destroys a section of the Great Wall of China, as we've talked about, and then Superman has a new power, Restorovision, where he's able to look at something that has been destroyed and simply restore it with his eyeballs. Later, Nuclear Man flies over Manhattan holding the Statue of Liberty in a way that defies even the simplest viewer's notion of how the laws of gravity and physics actually work. In your face, science teachers. And while we're talking science, Superman somehow has the ability to fly Mariel Hemingway into outer space without the aid of oxygen or a spacesuit. I pondered. Wow.
I want Neil deGrasse Tyson to watch this film and comment on it, because I think he made some things about, and fair enough with things like Gravity and some other films. And he does, and he's fair about it. I don't think he does this to really destroy things, and he gives credit where credit is due. So I appreciate what he does. But if he were to watch this film, I think he might throw up in his mouth and swallow, because it is awful.
Yep. It is. I know. And it even bothered me that I think they have, they're still using some of the John Williams music, even though Giorgio Moroder? No, you know who I mean.
Yes.
He is the one credited with the score, but they do recycle some of the John Williams music. I don't think we should talk about this much longer, other than say they recycle certain things, like there's another Lois and Superman flying scene, and there's also the magical amnesia kiss.
But the idea of trying to save the, like do this kind of thing, which you try to do right, like Star Trek IV, Save the Whales, A Voyage Home, brilliant, and it had that message. Sometimes you can actually do that and do it right. But then there was this... then there was Superman Quest, you know, where he wants to get rid of nuclear armament. And that's something I'm very much for. Like, if we just get rid of all nuclear weapons everywhere, I would be a very happy camper. I'm not sure why we haven't.
You hippie?
This film, yeah. Peace out.
I'm with
but,
you.
But, yeah, this was not, yeah. I don't know how, based on a script or anything, how anyone greenlights this based on what was there. There was this Steven Seagal, it's not science fiction, of course, but it was Steven Seagal one that even had Michael Caine. I guess maybe that was the only role that Michael Caine was in that I would question, because he's such a great actor. But there was on Deadly Ground or something, where it was again another one of these high-handed save the planet kind of fiascos that's just horrific. So this was, I mean, if this is a horror movie, like, let's consider this as a horror film, I would give it like 4 out of 5 or 5 out of 5. Yeah. But I don't think that's what the intention was.
Well, I will say this, David, that I've noticed having, I know I lived through the 80s, and we saw a lot of egregious miscalls, especially in cinema, through the 1980s, and a lot of those egregious miscalls were attributable to cocaine, to nose candy. And so I don't know if this is one of those, but I would not be surprised, because I don't know how it gets greenlit either, other than people being as high as fuck and not knowing any better.
Yeah, and Nuclear Man is one of the most horrific things you can imagine. Like, it reminds me of Earth Final Conflict, the Gene Roddenberry's Earth Final Conflict, later seasons where they brought in this character called Howland.
Yeah.
And it was just, even though that was much better, and what they did with that character and the effects and everything else was so much better than this. But this one was so bad.
And Gene Hackman keeps saying Nuclear Man, which I don't get, because I mean, I don't think it was a decision, like a character decision. I thought, you know, well, Lex is supposed to be an evil genius. He would know how to pronounce nuclear. But for whatever reason, Hackman keeps saying nuclear.
Unless he's like George Bush, like one of the, I think it might have been the younger Bush, always kept saying nuclear instead of nuclear. And maybe it is a certain way of saying it from maybe a certain area that you, they tend to like foyer versus foyer.
Yes.
That kind of thing. Right. That maybe some, but or film versus film.
Yeah. 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 You've got me. You got me on that one. Okay. So,
but that's one good thing, by the way. Gene Hackman is makes this a one instead of a zero or half, because Gene Hackman's great.
And even like the scenes with him and John Cryer, you know, they're watchable. Like they're you know, they're not well written, they're not well shot, but they're watchable. That's about all I will say.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, so this is my lowest rated Superman film of them all. I gave it one super S out of five.
And I'll give it half I won't give it zero. I'll give it half because of Gene Hackman.
Yeah,
and of course, Christopher Reeve, of course.
Yeah. I like your objectivity. I probably should have done that too. Whoa, Dave. Dave, do you see what we just did? I can't believe we did this.
What, we went long again?
We went super long. We went super long. We might have to like go back in time. Well, actually, we can't. If we were super, we could go back in time and fix it. But it looks like we are going to have to take a break and carry on to another episode of Superman at the Movies. So, yeah.
Well, this episode ends at Ick. It's supercalifragilistic, and then the second part will be expialidocious. So that's how we will break it.
This is just like the old cliffhanger serials. You know, you're gonna have to come back and see
Perils of Pauline.
Yeah, see how our Superman at the Movies goes, right? Because that's it for now. Right?
Did David and Troy jump out of that carriage before it ended up over into that abyss or that ravine
and
or whatever it
was? And I don't know, David. I can't tell you why. You know why? Because Superman came and he kissed me on the lips and I can't remember.
Well, can we remember how we actually end the episode? And maybe we'll do that.
No, I don't think we can. But yeah, let's see. We say something like, remember to catch us on your favorite podcast provider, be that Spotify or Podcast Addict or what have you. Please check us out on our website, if you like. That's 2of.ca, numeric 2. And of course, Facebook. We're all over Facebook. You know, so much Facebook. And just your favorite podcast provider, really. Tell a friend, like and subscribe. That's it.
Yep. And I'm David Klink.
And I'm Troy Harkin.
And see you all for part two of our movie look at Superman on Two Old Farts
Talk Sci-Fi.